Alexa, what time is it?
The time is 6:27 p.m.
Welcome to the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Blue and yellow till we die. I'm Ian Tiny Morris.
And I'm Simon Sainsbury. Well, there we go. This is kind of take two of our episode. If you weren't involved in yesterday's calamity, we tried to do the episode last night at a normal time, but Zoom kept kicking Ian out.
Yeah, it was not inclusive yesterday. It was not having a bar of it. I couldn't see it. It couldn't see me. It was an omni shambles.
Yes, it just wasn't playing very well at all. So we're giving it another go tonight. So we've got into the habit lately, haven't we, of starting off with it on this day, but we've hastily recobbled together some on this days for today instead of yesterday. But briefly, let's visit kind of what we were talking. So how's the week that's just gone, Ian?
Yeah, it's been a funny old week, to be honest. It's day, 100 and quite a few now. So, yeah, just really bimbling along. And it's that kind of, you know, you enjoy the weekend, you're back into work. And, yeah, it's kind of a little bit meh last week, I think.
A little bit meh?
As in meh?
M-E-H?
Yeah, exactly that.
I thought that was just some badly pronounced French and you were going for merde.
No, the bar of that. That's what we voted to spare ourselves from.
Badly pronounced French words.
Exactly.
Indeed.
I've got a CSE grade 4 in French, you know.
Have you?
C'est incroyable. Avez-vous un grand pompomousse?
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I think that's enough of that one then. So yes, on this day, which worked a bit better yesterday when we tried it, but today I want to start on this day by talking about something that happened on our last successful podcast, and we used the word probably quite wrongly, on our last successful podcast, which was Sunday the 21st. During our conversation with Nick Sibley, towards the end of the episode, I just want to make it clear, I made a reference to an airborne advert that flew over the city during the climate hustings in the last general election in December, and I really want to make it clear that Donna Jones wasn't actually connected with that airplane in any way, just in case anybody mistook my banter for a claim that it was. I'm sure that people don't see it that that's the case, but I think it's important to be clear about that. So that's what happened on that day, but other days in history. So going back a lot further than obviously the week before, you know, the last week and a day, on 512, the solar eclipse was recorded by a monastic chronicler in Ireland.
God, I love a solar eclipse. I'm trying to remember when the last one was. There was a proper one. I was working... so I reckon I want to say 98 or 99.
I can't remember. They happen frequently. They're great events. Obviously, if you do see a solar eclipse, do take precautions with your eyewear, not like Donald Trump. Don't stare right at a solar eclipse. It's a really silly thing to do. I was going to say something else then, but I didn't know whether you were going for... Was it Bonnie Tyler?
2090, so I don't know either of us are going to catch that one.
Well, you never know. You never know. Was it Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart?
Yes.
Living
yes,
in a powder keg and giving off sparks. I'm frequently singing the Glee cover of that while I'm pounding the treadmill. Sister. Yes. Yeah,
oh, that was... good man.
Yes. Outrageous. This is a family show. Good evening, Malcolm and Lynn. We have a bit of a sense of deja vu, but I'm glad that some of you have still actually made it through the chaos. So 1377, the French raided Rye in England.
Outrageous.
Lovely place. I stayed there with my daughter once.
Have seven C's?
Sorry?
Queen, seven C's of rye.
We're keeping on with the musical references. Yep. Yeah, there's seven C's of rye. That's right. I don't know that it's connected to the place at all. 1540, former Lord Privy Seal and Chancellor of the Exchequer of England, Thomas Cromwell, is indicted as a heretic.
That did go well for him, did it?
No, there we go, these bloody unelected bureaucrats. 1613, Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London, England, burns down during a performance of Henry VIII.
No bad thing.
Well, most theatre organisations want to raise the roof, but not literally raise the building to the ground, I guess. 1858, the Great Fire in London docks. In 1932, the USSR and China sign a non-aggression treaty. And in 1949, South Africa begins implementing apartheid with no mixed marriages. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act passed after 83-day filibuster in the US Senate. Interesting, isn't it, that bookending two... You know, talking about two completely different ends of the spectrum with regards to equal rights. And even when people are trying to pass equality legislation, there are numpties that stand in the way and completely pull things along.
Yeah.
But there we go. Being on the wrong side of history, it's, you know, something that lots of people seem to want to do. Hey-ho.
I think this is one of the things we've learned over the last, particularly over the last few months, is that you don't actually have to look back very far in history to make yourself feel a bit uncomfortable. I was reading a James Bond novel last week. Came through on a deal of the day, Moonraker, 1955. There's some stuff in there that has your eyebrows going over the back of your head.
Well, Ian Fleming was convinced that homosexuals couldn't whistle.
Yeah, he does mention homosexuals in there. And there was one where M's describing a... He said, a decent sort of chap. A Jew, a decent sort of chap.
Oh, good grief.
Like, did you just say that out loud?
Yeah, there is some stuff. Well, there's some stuff that ages really, really badly. And that's good because it shows that there's progress in our society, right? So,
Yeah.
One of the things that we had on our list to talk about was about July the 4th being the opening of beer establishments, of pubs.
Yes.
And in honour of that, yesterday we both opened a beer. Lynn sadly doesn't have a G&T today like she had yesterday. I don't know whether that's just a supplies issue or because it's a school night, but we're sorry you, Lynn. But we're not going to... I'm still going to pour myself a beer, I'm sorry. So July the 4th, Ian, are you going to be going to the pub?
Long story short, no. So there is an element of, you know, I fess up, not a regular these days. Find the pub terrifyingly expensive most of the time. Take my beer at home. I guess, you know, with it being the summer, I tend to equate hydration after a cricket match with my blind cricket team as being the principal reason for going to the pub. And as it stands at the moment, whilst there is international cricket, I think, starting next week, that's going to be behind closed doors. And as for my season, it doesn't look like that's going to happen at all. So ultimately, shall we just go to the pub? I'm not sure I fancy it.
Well, for the three of you that were listening to the conversation before everything went completely wrong yesterday, I'm also not a ferocious attender of pubs. I rarely drink beer. I only tend to do that when it's actually unfeasibly hot. So that kind of tells you how hot it's been lately, although not so much today, I guess. A lot of establishments are going to struggle with what arrangements they need to put in place. The staff might have to be negotiating some rules that are in place to try and make sure that what distancing is required, that there might be differing facilities. We spoke about Spoons having an app so you can order and therefore don't need to go to the bar, which might be something that larger organisations have both space in their pubs and the ability to develop technical solutions like that, whereas some of the smaller, more independent establishments won't quite have some of those advantages, will they?
Yeah, and I think it's that balancing act, isn't it? And I know our local, the Portsbridge, isn't opening on Saturday. It's actually waiting until the Monday. And they've got a booking app. So effectively, you have to book in advance to go to the pub, which I guess is a good way of controlling numbers. But I think the logistics of social distancing in that situation, I guess there's going to be elements of precaution, aren't there? But it's not going to be an absolute. But I think, you know, this is where it becomes a bit of a balancing act, doesn't it? Because, you know, folk who have been around supermarkets or are out and about, you know, find that people are already not as respectful of the 2 metre distance as they were. So I think it's just going to be a gradual reduction in the sort of the distancing piece. But there's an element for me when I think about these things in terms of, it's a balance of risk versus reward, isn't it? You know, if my social life was based around going to the pub and that was my big thing, then I'd perhaps feel more motivated to go than, you know, at the moment, you know, I'm holding out for the gyms to reopen. And that's one of those ones where, again, social distancing not going to be easy, but I'd be much more comfortable going to the gym than I would be going to the pub.
Yeah, I guess. And also, as people get steadily drink a bit more, then they're even less likely to be compliant, aren't they? So my thoughts and sympathies are with the staff trying to negotiate those tricky situations and deal with hopefully not too over eager customers that feel that they've suddenly got their freedom. But going for it on a Saturday, July the 4th, seems a bit of a big kind of something showy offy without kind of little substance and forethought. But, you know, who'd have thought of that from Boris Johnson's government?
Now, I think, well, the trouble is, isn't it? And again, you've seen some of the debates on social media, isn't it? It's that, you know, the rules are still the rules. The fact that an awful lot of people, well, a significant and noticeable number of people are not following the rules. You know, for me, that's a people problem. You know, that's not a policy problem. The fact that you can't get, you know, it's been well documented, the issues down at, you know, Southsea and the hot walls, and the fact that they had to put a dispersal order in place, you know, that's not about policy. That's just about people, you know, not being, what's the polite word for dicks? Non-compliant.
I don't know, but you've kind of said it anyway. So let's just hope that nothing as awful as what happened as the scenes that we saw in Bournemouth takes place in Southsea. As it is, there seem to have been, you know, some problems with some people being in large groups and not conducting themselves in a sociable manner, shall we say, and quite literally being antisocial when starting fights, which sadly happens most summers as well anyway. Sadly,
well,
I don't know what it is about temperature
that is
and
the thing.
Brain
you know,
cells
my,
being...
My...
killed off.
My eldest lad worked down at the Clarence on the seafront. You know, lovely Brewers Fair pub. But what he found is on a day, you know, one of those red hot days, is you'd have people starting at 11 o'clock in the morning. They'd drink through, and then by the time it got to 7, 8 o'clock at night, you know, basically anything could spark trouble at any point. And I think, you know, whilst the pubs haven't been there, if you're skilled in the art of finding an off license, you've still been able to sit in the sun and drink all day.
It's sadly some sort of lack of social responsibility that some people have, that when partnered with alcohol, they don't have the what's that word? Common sense, isn't it? To not drink more than they can handle and turn into complete numpties.
What's the polite word for dicks?
No, I was just avoiding that because, you know me, I I rarely swear. Which of course isn't true to anybody that's ever known me. So neither of us are going to go to a pub.
Nope.
We wish well anybody that is going to attend, and we certainly wish well anybody that is going to be working in them. Good luck.
Yeah, and I did muse on it in terms of the following Saturday. It's my birthday, so last year it was my 50th, and I can say with no shadow of a doubt that I did properly go to the pub. Really, really a lot.
Really a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was very bad the next day.
You shocked me.
But this year I looked at it and I thought, well, you know, do you go out for a meal? But ultimately, for me, if you're going to go out for a meal, and let's face it, that's not a cheap option these days. But I want to relax and enjoy myself. And if I've got screens and, you know, it all just feels like a bit of a faff and a bit stressful. And, you know, in the end, I'd rather not bother.
Not the same sort of experience. I guess the only benefit for me, if I was going to be going to a pub, would be that I assume that they won't be showing live football matches, because that would encourage people to get excitable. I understand that is at least the policy of a certain leading pub chain.
Is that your mate Tim?
Yeah. I was texting him earlier on. And I guess that would be because I'm sorry, as I destroy my ability to be electable in Cosham, I'm not a fan of football. It doesn't bother me. That's me kind of dropping in popularity.
The best way to do that, son, is to put Lib Dem on the ballot paper. Ba-boom.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well.
Come on, you had your Boris job. I won't let you get
okay. Fair enough. No, that's fine. I mean, it was enough for us to talk about when we were planning the episode, and I suggested to Ian that we do at least a brief conversation about the Lib Dem leadership contest, and Ian said, is there a Lib Dem leadership contest?
To be fair, you haven't had the media coverage you should have done. I don't think we'll come on to that later.
No, we have. So we'll save all of the excitement for that. But just so that everybody knows that hasn't swung by our Facebook page lately, I've created a Simonometer to indicate which side I'm swinging to. Not that, Ian. In regards to Layla or Ed as my vote in the leadership contest. And at the moment, I'm characteristically in the middle. So keep updated with the Simonometer. We've got a swingometer, but I've called it a Simonometer because I just like doing those awful things with consonants. But our second subject was going to be slightly different, which was the stay or go question.
They'll go, is this Robert Jenrick?
Yes, developer extraordinaire.
Well, so let's deal with the facts as we know them, which is...
Are the actual facts, here, not the ones from Conservative
the
Party
actual
office.
Facts. So we'll deal with the facts as we know them.
Okay.
So he ends up being sat next to Richard Desmond, who is a property developer now, whereas historically he was a print media mogul, I think would be the appropriate term, although some of his publications were only accessible to, how can I put it, taller members of society. But now he's into property developing, and he ends up sat next to our man at the fundraiser. Texts are exchanged about a housing development that he is trying to get built in Tower Hamlets. It's a redevelopment, 1,500 homes. And he's asking if we could get a bit of a move on and approve it, because there's an upcoming change where there will be a local levy needing to be paid, which would result in a sum of about £40 million being paid to the Labour-led Tower Hamlets Council.
You mean the democratically elected council to represent the people in Tower Hamlets?
Yes. Yeah, no, I made no value judgment about how these people were elected. I was just colouring the story with the fact that it was a Labour-led council.
Of course.
So Robert Jenrick, fortunately, approves said piece of planning permission. Forgive me, I need to deal with my dog. So I'm going to carry you at this point, Simon. Don't be alarmed in any way, shape or form. So Robert Jenrick approves the planning application. By lucky chance, the day before the levy is due.
What a coincidence.
In a unrelated coincidence, 12 days later, Mr. Desmond donates £12,000 to the Conservative Party. Some say that this does not look good and that it is not appropriate what has gone on and that our friend Mr. Jenrick should resign his position. Thus far, he has steadfastly not resigned and the Prime Minister has said he considers the matter closed. That all seems perfectly fair, doesn't it?
Yeah, I do, knowing what, because I, spoiler, I know what you're going to say. Is it, shall I come in with just a kind of little bit of...
Oh, I'd like to see your thoughts. I mean, you seem a fair and balanced man, reasonable fellow for a Lib Dem.
I'm fair and I've...
Live and let live, that sort of thing.
I've even been called balanced on occasion.
I do need to add this in.
Yeah.
Since approving it, he suggested that because it might look a bit fishy, there's nothing fishy going on, but it might look like it is, he's now overturned his own decision and referred the decision to an independent minister to look over the application.
But that was after the media furore, yes?
I couldn't be exact on timing, but... might think that
I've got so on my little collection of notes, Robert Jenrick, who's a housing expert. I mean, he must be because he's got three of them, which of course he's perfectly entitled to have. In January he granted permission for the £1 billion development in East London, overruling advice from an inspector and from officials. Who had said that it wasn't a good local fit and it lacked, and it was lacking in social housing. It was really strange, like you say.
Man's got to make a profit.
Really strange coincidence that his decision saved Richard Desmond a £45 million levy in taxation that he would have been subject to had the appeal not taken place on the day that had the decision not taken place on the day that it did, the day before those that tax came into effect. It's also a strange coincidence, and like you say, Ian, of course, entirely unrelated, that Robert Jenrick sat next to Richard Desmond. I'm sure that nobody shortens his name in the common shortening of the name Richard, at a November Conservative Party fundraiser, but he doesn't appear to have donated money at that fundraiser, or at least not a declarable amount of money at that fundraiser. But he did donate £12,000 to the Conservative Party weeks after the approval was granted. So it does.
That's not true.
I'm merely quoting what was reported elsewhere.
It was 12 days.
12 days.
Yeah, after less than 2 weeks, isn't it? So the statement of weeks was factually incorrect.
But 12 days is more than 1 week, right?
It's not weeks though. It's a week and a bit.
It's more than 1 week. To be honest with you, whether it was 3 days later or 7 weeks later, the point is, doesn't appear to have made a donation at the fundraising event in November, where he showed a video to Robert Jenrick regarding the development. But once he was saved £45 million in taxes, he then did make a £12,000 donation. I mean, the investors amongst us would probably see that £12,000 for a saving of £45 million as a really good return on investment.
I think that makes him a wrong'un.
You think that makes him a wrong'un?
Mm.
Okay. Why?
Because to be fair...
I mean, I don't disagree with you, but I'm interested to see your...
If the wheels have been greased to the tune of £45 million, you'd rather hope for a bit more of a suck of the sore spot than 12K, wouldn't you?
So you think his bung should have been more?
Well, it seems only reasonable to me. Yeah.
Is that because the Conservative Party are so ferociously short of funds?
Oh, we're not terrifically short of funds, but, you know.
I mean, I guess they're...
Man's not short of a shilling, is he?
Well, it would appear not. So your verdict on Jenrick?
So we've had a bit of banter, and my feeling with this is I'm appalled, if I'm honest. You know, there is an element of... I'm old-fashioned in a way, Simon, and I believe in fair play. And ultimately, you know, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And this whole story just is distasteful, and it plays to the narrative of, oh, bloody Tories are looking after their own, aren't they? Looking after their own, yeah, money changing hands behind closed doors. And I just put my head in my hand and think, how stupid do you have to be to think in this day and age that that story isn't going to break? Even if you leave all the moral stuff about it being entirely the wrong thing to do to one side, and I'm not saying you should, but how do you think that that isn't going to get pieced together and your trousers are going to get yanked down? So when stood there with your trousers around your ankles, as Robert Jenrick has done, just to stand up and say, well, I'd just like to point out my trousers haven't been pulled down, and I refer the matter to a different trouser minister. I don't get it. I really don't get it.
Well, unsurprisingly, I don't disagree with you. I think that you should go, and it should be investigated independently with whatever is the appropriate process for this to be investigated.
So the Labour Party have called for the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner to be involved,
which is absolutely right in these circumstances. We may not all remember the lack of trust in our parliamentary system that was caused by, you know, the Cash for Questions scandal. Yep. And all of those sorts of things. At the end of the day, it's important that everybody has equal access to their democratically elected representatives, and that shouldn't be bought, and that organisations and people shouldn't be in a situation where they can effectively hand over a brown envelope or promise to hand over a brown envelope and hand it over later once they've actually been saved the bother of actually paying money towards public funds. Considering that if that development doesn't have the required level of social housing, doesn't fit with the area, so is going to be causing issue, you know, all sorts of problems for the other residents of the area, and isn't going to be solving the issues with providing socially affordable housing for people in London, just as much as in any other cities, for them to actually duck out of the £45 million charge. To use your own analogy, it's not cricket. It's not right. It shouldn't happen. And there should be a price to pay.
And the piece that I don't understand, and this is where I do find it all slightly incredible, is why you wouldn't resign in that situation. And that's the piece where I sort of struggle in my own mind, is that the right thing to do is to resign. I'm going to have to pick you up again and I'll let my dog back in. This is one of the downsides, of course, of having to broadcast when it is not balmy sunshine. you know, for me, the...
Well, I've got
politics is full of ministers that have been caught doing the wrong thing, some more serious than others. But even if it's just a question of judgment or an infidelity or a historically, they just used to do the right thing and resign. And I don't get why he hasn't.
C- can you're going to accuse me of being deeply partisan for pointing out the obvious, which is the reason why he hasn't gone, is because this particular administration has created an environment where successive ministers and successive representatives of the administration or advisors in the administration have made what normally, you're quite right, what normally would be falling on own sword kind of affairs. And I don't mean affairs as in being in someone else's bed.
But that would have been enough historically, wouldn't it?
To be fair, I'm not so attached to the example of marital infidelity because, you know, to be honest, at the end of the day, I'm less concerned about that than I am people taking bribes, or what appear to be bribes, I should be clear, in order to make decisions that favour the person issuing the donation. We've got people that are key parts of this government, or supposedly key parts of this government, despite being an unelected bureaucrat, interpreting rules to their own degree.
Really?
And yeah, because if you're in any other government, Ian, he would have been told to go. Because so he's just an example, and I'm not leveling him as a person, because at the end of the day, I don't have any truck with this evil demonization of him as a person. But at the end of the day, as a person involved, as a person doing the job that he's doing, any other advisor that was in that situation where they became a bigger story than the Prime Minister, they would be asked to go. Yeah. And
see,
there
we
are
can go down a rabbit hole here.
There are many
because
other.
You cannot control the media. So eight weeks on,
who'd want to control?
There
them?
Are still people posting every day about the non-story. And
but you
all
say
of the
it's
people
a non-
who are posting those stories,
mm.
who are trying to keep that story in the media, are angry Remainers who despise him because he's the architect of Brexit.
Okay.
Well, that's how they perceive it.
But
it has nothing to do.
Well, Ian, I haven't pressed a button and dropped you out, but you seem to have dropped connection. Are you still there? Well, that's unfortunate. Let me just try and make sure that Ian's back. Ian, are you still there? Oh, you seem to have dropped out and come back in. Hang on. For some reason, he's on his... The image is on its side. Ian appears to have come back muted. Yep, you're back.
Yep, I'm unmuted. I'm back.
Don't worry. I puffed rather than kind of making my reply while you were kind of digitally incapacitated. I mean, to be fair, that's nice gaslighting. But at the end of the day, I'm not saying this as an angry Remainer. I'm saying this as someone, because to be, you know, we've talked at length about, obviously, my views about how Brexit went are quite clear.
Yep.
But this isn't about revenge for Brexit. This is about responding to your point that in any other administration, in previous governments, people mired in scandal or seemed to be doing the wrong thing would be asked to step aside, or they would be sacked. And the reason your question was, why hasn't Jenwick done that? And the answer is because Johnson's government has successively not asked people to do that when they've actually done things that in previous governments they would have done. So it's because that standard has been set and it has been lowered. Dominic Cummings is, of course, the most visible and memorable recent example. But I don't pick on that because I'm obsessed by going on about Dominic Cummings. I just pick that because it's the clearest, most recent example. I couldn't list to you all the others, but it's just the reason why is because that's the standard that the Johnson government operates under. And you seem shocked that people don't behave with honour and decency.
Yes. Yeah, I don't see the two as the same.
But it's because of how Johnson's running his government.
Because okay, at the end of the day, it's about personal responsibility, isn't it?
Yes, but...
So should Johnson sack him? Yes, I think he should.
Right, so why isn't
Will
he?
No.
So why not?
And I don't know. I honestly don't know why he wouldn't. Because if I was in his position, I would have sacked him in a heartbeat.
Yes, but with due respect to you, you're a man of principle and honour, whereas our Prime Minister isn't.
Yeah, and perhaps there is an element to that. He has a slightly murkier past, but there's an element of, I guess, ultimately you have to make your decisions, and you know, I hope this one doesn't come back to haunt us. You know, and again, back to the bribe piece, £12,000. Whilst it's own, you know, some, if they gave it to you or I, I'm sure we'd be absolutely delighted with it.
But you think it was a bit cheap?
It's not a material amount of money in terms of the turnover of the Conservative Party. So, you know, it's for me, it's not a bribe issue, but it is acting improperly, and I don't like that.
So I guess where we both agree is that we want. And it seems like we're both agreeing that it would be a return, but what we're both asking for is actually an environment where propriety exists, and we expect of our representatives, the elected ones and the unelected ones, to behave and conduct themselves in a way that is reasonable. And I know we talked on previous episodes about holding them to impossible standards. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the common kind of decency thing of actually, the truth is in politics, sometimes it isn't actually whether you did a thing, it's actually whether it looks like you did a thing. And if you're the distraction that stops the government dealing with the issue of the day, or is a, you know, they're spending time dealing, responding to column inches or to media questions about issues that when we're dealing with a nationwide pandemic, then really actually you should kind of like, do you know what, this isn't the right thing for people to be focusing their time on, I should shuffle off.
Well, that unfortunately is where we differ, because I and again, you cannot control the media. The days of the thick of it and of Alistair Darling controlling the media are over. So there is an element of, if the media chooses to create or run with a non-story or inflate a story or conflate a story as being different to what it is, if that is the mood of the mob, you can't change that. And that's where, for me, the baying of the mob mentality means I change sides. At that point, I am not on the side of the baying mob.
So,
there's an element of, if you look at the generic story at face value, it is not a difficult story for you to follow the narrative of, and say, that's not right.
So does
now
that...
the fact is, in 2 weeks' time, no one will speak of. Oh, it might come up again if the ombudsman or if the parliamentary standards man says no, or if he investigates and says yes, he's done something wrong. But ultimately, it will not cover every tabloid headline and every social media group for the next 8 weeks.
To be fair, I don't think it's covered every tabloid headline, and it hasn't covered every social media group. And to be clear, I don't think you're suggesting this, but the concept of controlling the media, the point of having a free media is that you don't control them and they investigate and question and hold.
I absolutely get it, but there is an element of, when the investigation has happened and the finding has been found and the finding isn't what you want it to be, to then just make stuff up
in regards to generic,
keep pumping the air in the tyres of a non-story because you want it to be something different. That's where I start the struggle.
In regards to generic?
No, generic's fine.
Right.
My issue is with the Cummings story, which is still being posted on social media groups as the reason why people aren't social distancing.
Yeah, but to be fair, Ian, in a free society, lots of people with differing views will post all sorts of things, and some of them will will have, to be honest, will have an agenda, and actually some of them will be have an obsessive level of anger at particular things that happen. And you know, if you want to find anybody upset about anything, you'll always be able to find it on the internet. I just think to circle back to my answer to your question, why is it that he hasn't gone? It's because his boss has created the environment where it isn't necessary for him to do so.
And I can't necessarily argue with that, except to put a comma that says you shouldn't need your boss to sack you if it's obviously you've done the wrong thing.
No, you're right. You shouldn't. But in any environment where I don't think toxic's the right word, where it is where an environment is created where people can, to be blunt, get away with things that they shouldn't get away with, in any other organization or any other business, that environment is created and allowed to fester by the person or the people in charge, right? And they're responsible for the ethics of the organization.
The culture, the ethics. The culture, no, I don't know. Right? So I can't disagree with that.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of where. So, okay.
Shall we slide on to the second?
So let's slide on to the second part of this question, because this is where it kind of gets into. But before we do, let me just bring in some of the comments from the interweb, from our own little echo chamber. I asked the while you were talking, I asked whether the group thought that Jenrick should stay or go. Lynn and Malcolm both said that they thought he should go. Ivy points out that it isn't just angry Remainers, and that being rather a generalisation. Malcolm
from an angry Remainer.
But then why? Sorry, am I not English too? Do I not have a view about what happens in this country?
Oh, everyone's entitled to a view.
Right, exactly. But why categorising people because of an event that happened 4 years ago, and therefore deriding their opinions because of what their views are on that?
Because the two are linked.
Okay. Malcolm says that he's shocked that you're shocked about Cummings. Ivy goes on to say about it, basically disagreeing with it about it being a non-story, but I think we've kind of exhausted that point to any useful degree. So the second part of the stay or go question was the flip side. So this is where it might be actually quite interesting to see how the logic process that we've just gone through and our thought processes that we've just described apply to Rebecca Long Bailey's situation.
Yep.
Now, she was sacked from her shadow front bench position as shadow education minister by Keir Starmer. He sacked her after she'd posted a link to an article in which what can be possibly described as a conspiracy theory attempting to link the actions of the Israeli secret police to the murder of George Floyd in America. And she'd been asked to take down her original tweet and post a clarification. She'd posted a clarification but had refused to take down the tweet. And there's unsurprisingly a difference between Keir Starmer's office and Rebecca Long Bailey as to then this kind of sequence of events. But in a nutshell, Rebecca Long Bailey was relieved of her post. What's your thoughts? Should she have gone?
Should she have gone?
Yes.
Oh, and to be honest, there is an element of, you know, there are great similarities in this situation, which is the Labour Party has an anti-Semitism problem because it's perceived to have an anti-Semitism problem. And that is clearly linked to the left of the party, of which Rebecca Long Bailey was their hope for leader to be the Corbyn continuity candidate. So at that point, you have a situation where you repost a link, a story that has a clearly untrue and anti-Semitic trope within it. And your clarification is, it wasn't a blanket support of the whole story. I'm afraid at that point, you have to go. You just cannot stay. You know, Sir Keir Starmer set out very clearly, I think his first meeting was with the Jewish Council of Deputies to say that this was an area he was going to personally address. And a front bencher making such a tweet simply cannot stay.
So some of the, it appears that there's a bit of a disagreement within the Labour Party from some of its supporters as to whether they support or not Keir Starmer's move to sack Rebecca Long-Bailey.
I looked at another angry voice, which mm-hmm. is a very vocal left-leaning, and I would say 60% of the people responding to that story, where another angry voice said that he was wrong to sack Rebecca Long-Bailey, were either posting anti-Semitic material, were suggesting that their relationship with the Labour Party was over, and were basically denying that Rebecca Long-Bailey had done anything wrong.
Okay, and some of the, should we say, the person whose article Rebecca Long-Bailey linked to in her, yes. in her tweet, they've actually withdrawn their article, is that right?
So they sent out a clarification and an apology saying that that piece of the article mm-hmm. was untrue and that they regretted posting it and that they stood against racism and anti-Semitism as completely wrong.
Okay.
That for me is about, I have made a mistake and I'm sorry.
And indeed, although we all make mistakes, sometimes it's important to own up to them, but not all mistakes are excusable with an apology, I guess.
Absolutely.
Personally, I think that she should have gone. It was right for Keir to dismiss her. And even if you, to be blunt, even if actually you, whether you disagree or agree as to whether that trope in and of itself was anti-Semitic, the point that someone on his shadow front bench goes anywhere near the orbit of suggesting or talking about anything to do with Israel or to do with anything, bearing in mind what a contentious and dangerous issue it is and how easily it is to get that wrong. For her to have demonstrated the lack of judgment of doing that in the first place is one thing. For Keir, either his leadership is going to be consumed by the same battle that consumed the Corbyn leadership, or he had no choice but to say, off you go. You know, he gave her a chance to withdraw the tweet. He gave her a chance to explain. She chose to explain but not withdraw the tweet. So leaving
she
it
didn't
up there.
Explain. And that's the difference for me, Simon. She did was folded her arms and said, she didn't address the fact that it contained an anti-Semitic trope. You know, there was no acknowledgement of that. That for me is the piece of, you know, like when you tell a child to say sorry, well, I'm not going to, can't make me. And that was her response. You know, it was bottom lip out. Ooh, didn't do it. Well, you did. And the fact is that if you can't see that, if you can't see George Floyd, yeah, you know what, his death linked to the Israeli secret services. If you can't see that that's anti-Semitic in its nature, then there's no helping you.
So another thing that was talked about was the Morning Star? So take that with the pinch of whatever flavoured salt you like. That there was the theory that Keir Starmer had actually been advised that he needed to get rid of Rebecca Long Bailey anyway because of her support for the National Education Union. And that causing an issue with regards to challenging the government's positions or actions around actually getting children back to school. And that because she was too vociferous in her support of the NEU, that basically she wasn't fit for the role and needed to be moved out of that role. That's the that's the union of which recent Portsmouth North parliamentary candidate Amanda Martin is president of.
Yeah, and again, there is an element of, you know, perhaps that's the case. You know, it will make you no surprises that I don't think Rebecca Long Bailey is fit to be anywhere. But the fact is that ultimately, you know, she's been given a front bench job. She's behaving in the way that you would expect her to. And, you know, that's a value judgment. But she's done nothing that any Labour leader could sack her for, you know, for supporting the position of the union. So, you know, for me, that makes it doubly, trebly stupid that you would go to the, you know, you go to the sorest spot that Labour have got and jab your finger right in it and do the, does that hurt? Does that hurt? You know, at the end of the day, either she was looking to get sacked or, and I have another theory, I'm going to throw this one out there, Keir Starmer is doing so well and playing so well that the hard left element in Labour are looking for a death match with him, and the Rebecca Long Bailey sacking is the catalyst to start that war.
I don't quite understand the logic of that, but don't worry about not bothering to expand it. So it seems that we both agree that at the end of the day, Keir Starmer's done the right thing in relieving her of her post, and that's the kind of the right thing. Of course, it is worth, and I'm cautious of the whataboutery nature of my following statement, but it is also worth remembering that other parties have issues with racist or anti particular religious groups statements within their ranks. And they should all be dealt with. See, I think they should all be dealt with independently, and the party should all sign up to agreeing to live by those rulings and those adjudications. Because it, you know, for national or local politicians to be making, you know, sharing racist material or promoting racist agendas isn't something that reflects well on them or their party or the people that they represent.
So the question you have to ask is, how does the party deal with those things? And that for me is the, you know, and again, in the interest of time, I don't think you're going to walk down the road that you're looking to stroll down. You know, ultimately you have a mechanism within parties to deal with these issues. And I think, you know, if you look at the situation within, you know, if you look at the specifics within the Labour Party, there is a proportion of the party that are right to talk about the, you know, the Israeli government and their human rights records. And the Israeli government has a very poor human rights record, as does China, as does Russia, ASDA's insert the name of 30 or 40 countries around the world. My issue is that the government that the hard left predominantly want to talk about is Israel. And that is significantly, you know, it is exceptional in its nature. And unfortunately, there are a proportion of people on the very hard left who conflate capitalism, wealth, and Judaism as being a thread of evil in the world. And, you know, that is something that, you know, Keir Starmer is committed to stamping out, and I wish him every success in his endeavour.
It's worth, I guess, pointing out that I don't know what analysis or data there is to actually demonstrate that, you know, that sort of claim. I guess my point would be that, and it kind of echoes what Malcolm was saying, which is that, you know, it matters little whether they're right or wrong or not. It's the perception. Of doing something wrong. And that kind of speaks back to our conversation about Robert Jenkins, is that, you know, I have no idea whether that's actually illegal or whether that even breaches parliamentary standards. That would be investigated. But the point is, and as what we were both saying earlier on in the question, is what happens to the concept of I've done something wrong and it's serious enough, or I've created a storm that's serious enough that actually I should pack my bags and take my place.
If we just put a brackets around this section, I would say both people have done something wrong enough that they should have resigned. And ultimately, one leader has shown strong moral compass leadership and sacked the transgressor. And unfortunately for me in this episode, the other leader has looked the other way and said nothing to see here, which is disappointing.
So is that a statement of support for Sir Keir Starmer?
Yeah, I think he's done very well. I think he's done the right thing.
I'm sure that the left will be, or, you know, the left, whoever and whatever they consider themselves to be, because it's as amorphous and technical as saying they, isn't it? I'm sure they will be thrilled to know that Keir Starmer's got your support. I can imagine that going down well
on this topic alone. But there might be others. I'm a reasonable and fair man, as you know. So how are we doing for time there, Simon, because I've only got my one headset on?
So well, good grief, we're at 25 minutes past. Do we quickly briefly talk about,
come on, who's the runners and riders?
Okay, the Lib Dem leadership contest, obviously, yes, caused by Jo Swinson losing her seat in the December general election. The party had originally said that it was going to actually put off the leadership election until 2021. That was kind of at the start that the whole COVID situation was happening. But as it's become apparent that we can quite reasonably hold hustings, etc., using digital services, then actually there's no reason for that leadership contest not to go ahead. The contest started with three people saying they were going to be chucking their hat into the ring. The closure of nominations is actually July 9th. The original kind of people at the start of the race, even though the race hadn't started, was Vera Hobhouse, Ed Davey and Leila Moran. Vera has actually pulled out, thrown her support behind Leila, and both candidates have reached the required level of nomination from party members. So they both got nominations from three MPs. Ed's got member nominations from 1,268. Leila has 923. And they were required to have nomination from members with 20 different local parties. And Ed has 288 local parties and Leila has 290 local parties. So they're both in the running. Ed, I guess kind of I haven't made any kind of call either way at the moment. I know that listeners may well remember that I voted for Ed in the last leadership election that the Liberal Democrats held, which was only last year. So the leadership election of 2020, haven't made my call just yet. I guess you've got Ed.
I can.
What?
That's only one answer.
What was the question?
Well, who to vote for.
Okay, but you don't get a vote.
Yeah, but I know it would if I could.
Okay, but if you're interested in joining the Liberal Democrats, then you need to do so by midnight July 9th in order to have a say in the leadership election.
I think, unfortunately, my Conservative Party membership...
Yes, you wouldn't be allowed to because you're already a member of another political party. So I guess what's... So on one hand, you've got Ed, the man of experience, with a really passionate and strong green agenda. He was responsible for the UK's quadrupling of renewable generation capacity, which last time I looked meant that we hadn't actually required any coal generation since sometime in April, the longest time since the Industrial Revolution. The downside being that he's linked with his time in coalition and therefore is perceived as by some as... So the question is that is there a perception of kind of tainted goods? But he has experience in a strong kind of green and caring agenda. Layla obviously wasn't involved in the coalition because she was first elected as an MP in 2017. And so is a fresher face, if you like, is our education spokesperson and has a strong background and experiences that have taught her about internationalism and learning about how education is really, really important and wants to... there have been some press articles about saying that Layla is saying that the party should take a jump to the left to try and pick up Corbynistas.
And then a step to the right.
Yes, I did make that comment as the time warp. I don't think Ed has kind of made a similar sort of comment. I know that Tim Farron has wrote an article, was it The Spectator, saying that basically that wouldn't kind of really work because actually what we'd need to do would be to try and encourage some of the softer Tory vote to actually come to vote Lib Dem. And I don't quite understand, if I'm honest, the logic of trying to sweet talk Corbynistas, because the last thing they're going to do is vote Liberal Democrat, because they spent the last 12 months telling us how much they hate our guts. Indeed, what was it? Nick Tyrone wrote in the Spectator that the Labour's path to victory would be to destroy the Lib Dems, and that their way back to government would be to build a big tent of voters, so to destroy the Lib Dem vote instead of trying to reclaim their own voters from like the red wall, as it was. That seems to have obviously just be a bit of rubble at the minute.
Fascinating.
Yes.
I think we should, in the interest of time, I think we should pick this one up on the next.
Yes, we'll do a bit more on that later.
Because I've thought it through, and as your own personal Dominic Cummings, I can give you the strategy to maybe not win the next election, but at least do a lot better.
We'll hold that
over the next time.
You're most definitely not my own personal Dominic Cummings. Let's be really honest.
I've got to go for a drive just to check my eyesight.
Yeah, it's the same.
Millsy can manage it.
I'm sure Millsy can deal with that. So, yes. So there we are. We've not had quite the technical problems that we had yesterday. Thank you for bearing with us. Is there Malcolm saying another I agree with Ian at the moment? I'm thinking that was about the Keir Starmer was right or wrong.
That's just about everything. Malcolm
will always agree with
him. He's found himself agreeing
with
me more and more. He's coming towards the light. He's loving it.
You can take tablets for that, Malcolm. Lynn says that she thinks that Keir Starmer showed clear leadership. And Malcolm had previously said that he'd been worrying about Labour for years, pandering to the left, whilst content in not having a hope of being elected. There's a whole other conversation to open there, which Ian and I have both kind of agree on, about the difference between radical and unelectable. Yes, so that's kind of like our comments. So I think that's a good place for us to leave, but we'll be back to our normal time on Sunday, the Zoom gods willing. So you've been listening to the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Blue and yellow, till we die. I've been Ian Tiny Morris.
And I've been Simon Sainsbury.